So I feel kind of bad for speaking ill of the dead.
But,
having said that.
But Chris forced me to. Chris, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not my choice anymore.
Hello and welcome to Further Research Needed, a place to store those results with p-values greater than 0.05. My name is Christopher Wood, and I'm joined by my co-hosts,
Jan-Philipp Reising,
Hannes Feurer.
And today I want to ask the question, does winning the Nobel Prize cause scientists to go mad? But, well, first, let's cheers.
Ooh. Ooh, shit. Cheers, guys.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers. I'm on the coffee today, but hey, cheers.
I just doused my microphone and beer.
Okay, so this episode's a bit of a change from the previous ones, as I've set my fellow hosts homework.
We do this so much.
So, I've noticed there's a trend, well, more of an association between scientists who have won a Nobel Prize and who then go, after they've received it, as one website stated, off the deep end. So I definitely recommend everyone Google Nobel Prize winners who went mad, as it is a great way to lose a few hours down a huge internet rabbit hole. There are lots of stories that come up, and each of them have their own idiosyncrasies, but they also have recurring themes between them. But before we get into this, to set the scene, last week I set all of us the task of researching one story and for them to bring it in today for the class. So, which of you would like to go first?
Philip, you go ahead. Okay. I think you have something nice.
Thanks for volunteering me, Hannes. So I directly or immediately thought of Linus Pauling, which I guess you guys know and probably know a lot more about than me. So for everybody who's not familiar, he's one of the few people who actually received two Nobel Prizes, one in chemistry and one for peace. And he's the only person ever to have two unshared Nobel Prizes. So it's very common to have like a shared Nobel Prize, which doesn't make it any less prestigious, but usually you have like a group of people who worked on the same thing. But in his case, he doesn't have to share. Pretty nice. And he's only one of two people who ever got it in two different fields. The other person being Marie Curie. So, yeah, definitely pretty amazing scientist. Do you guys know, like, at the top of your head, what he was doing research on?
So it's quantum physics and specifically chemistry, because I know of Pauling's rules in, I think it's building up the electrons in the atom.
Yeah,
which exactly. Electron, how you fill the electron shells one after the other, like you jump and then you come back and
so not to go into too much detail, that was like spot on summary, I would say. So it's also about electron negativity, so like how the electron bond is shared between atoms.
Just as an aside, I got the polling thing wrong. Pauli did the building up the element electrons in the atom. Pauling did the crystal structure, predicting crystal structures. Oops.
So I kind of wanted to say I keep confusing Pauli and Pauling.
Yeah.
And there we go. You also did it. That's amazing. We're going to edit this later.
But I think what you said wasn't that wrong. Or maybe,
The bonding. You're right. He did covalent bonding, but he didn't...
the shells.
He didn't do the Aufbau principle, the building up of electrons in the atom.
And then what I didn't know is that he also was part of the group who first published the structures or the structural elements in protein folding. So he was involved in coming up with alpha helices and beta sheets as a structural motif in proteins, which is something as a life science scientist you think about quite a bit. So I'm not that much into chemistry anymore. So going through his like list of achievements, I was like, oh yeah, I had that in like high school chemistry, or I had this in like maybe undergrad courses. But that he was also involved in these like protein structures is really interesting, and also shows like how broad his career was and what kind of things he was interested in. And then, so that's basically the work that his Nobel Prize in chemistry is based on. And then he also got the Peace Nobel Prize, as I said, for his work on, or as a peace activist after the Second World War, so starting in 1962, who's involved in trying to prevent nuclear war and that kind of stuff. So he was involved in founding some of the foundations that were really influential at that time. So yeah, definitely an interesting guy. But then, as Chris put it, he kind of goes into the deep end at some point. So the story that is being told is that in his 40s, so which is also the 1940s, he gets Bright's disease, or maybe Edison disease, which name you are more familiar with. And he gets this tip that if he changes his diet, that this might help. And it actually turns out that that's the case. So he basically eats like a super low salt diet, lots of vitamins and stuff like that. And that's basically, this regimen really helps him deal with that disease, which is pretty common in a couple of diseases. Certain things, for example, stuff that's involved with the immune system, if you change your diet, that can have a profound influence. What most people are probably familiar with is your skin and how healthy it is also has like a very direct connection how healthy you are eating. So at this point, everything is still fine. And that somehow from this experience, he shifts over into something called orthomolecular medicine. Does that mean anything to you?
No.
No.
So in this context, ortho means correct from the Greek. And it's basically to correct imbalances in the body, for example, by providing more vitamins and having different nutritional foods and that kind of stuff, which in and of itself is not yet bonkers, but especially, so he basically kicked off orthomolecular medicine as a field. He also created this, the Linus Pauling Institute of Science and Medicine, which promoted this orthomolecular medicine quite a bit. And his stick was basically mega vitamin therapy. So I don't know if mm-hmm. you've heard of this, but it's basically he promoted to eat loads of vitamin C. So he was eating like 3 or 4 grams of vitamin C a day. And your recommended intake is in the milligrams range.
You just pee it out. It's just enriching your urine rather than anything else. Is there
any hypervitaminosis from vitamin C?
You mean,
I don't think so.
You mean that you get negative effects of it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to get to that in a bit. But so he basically starts out saying, oh, yeah, you have to eat a lot of vitamin C, and that's going to help against the common cold. And he publishes on it, and he actually does research on it. So he's still kind of in the scientific community. And then,
can I ask?
Yeah, go.
When did he receive his Nobel Prizes? And when was that? When did he work on these things?
Okay, so in the 40s, he got this disease. And 1954, he got his Nobel Prize in chemistry and 62 in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 70s, he starts off with orthomolecular medicine. That's right. Like the first paper.
So after, for sure.
Yeah. So it's about like 15 years or so after his first Nobel Prize. And then you also have to think about, so he was born in 1901. So at that point, he's like in his 70s and he lived till he was 1994. So 93 years, which is quite old, I would say, for a man. Which is not to say that vitamin C therapy is actually working, which he claim to kind of prolong life, which no studies actually show. But so yeah, so he started out with vitamin C against the common cold, which I think it's maybe benign. But then in 1971, he actually starts this cancer therapy trial where he was giving high doses of vitamin C to terminal cancer patients with a doctor, like a Scottish doctor. And they claimed that the patients with in the vitamin C group had a 4 times higher survival length, basically, which would be a huge result. And it turns out the Mayo Clinic and other clinics have replicated that even at the time and showed that that's not the case. to which his response was, oh, this is just bad science and they are not doing a good job. But it actually turns out that his study design was flawed in the sense that he didn't select his groups correctly. So his vitamin C group started out, basically got the diagnosis earlier, which means you are statistically speaking more likely to survive longer. Because if you know it earlier, you still have way to go. So, it kind of turns from this genius guy in the chemistry field into maybe benign, maybe like science adjacent stuff, and then going into quite the deep end. And you were asking about actual toxicity. So for A and D, you have actual toxicity of the vitamins. For vitamin C, not so much. You can eat a lot without having real detriments. Mm-hmm. But studies by now have shown that A, vitamin C doesn't do anything at these doses. If anything, you might get more skin cancers, at least in rats, at high doses.
Oh, wow.
And the only thing they found where it had a positive effect was at near lethal doses in rats. So,
Jesus. Yeah,
not really something you would want to do. And the guy that did these studies was the leader of this Linus Pauling Institute for Science and Medicine, or like pretty high up in that hierarchy. And they immediately fired him, destroyed all of his research, and discredited him.
Sorry, whom? The doctor involved in these clinical trials?
Yeah, exactly. That showed that vitamin C basically doesn't do anything or is detrimental. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of like the biggest no-no in science you can do, at least from my perspective, to have people who disagree with you and have scientific evidence to back that up, to persecute them, to fire them. I mean, this is,
That's pretty bad.
Astonishing. Yeah, and I think what's really, just to put this in kind of a perspective, is vitamin C sales in the US right now are in the $100 million, and dietary supplements in general is a $18.3 billion industry. And he basically kicked that craze off with his aura as a two-time Nobel laureate, had a lot of pull with the American society.
Would you say he kicked it off, or he was a famous, incredible face for the movement?
So from what I've been reading, it's actually that he kicked it off. He started this and gave it, not only credibility, but he was like one of the first people who actually came up with it.
Hmm. I mean, today we have so much in this direction. We have vitamins, obviously, but also essential oils and basically every other thing you can think of. Someone will think it's going to save your life, right?
Yeah. So I think all of this falls into this supplementary stuff. And he was like one of the first people to push it on the population.
Wow. Vitamins are kind of interesting, though, because you do require them. They're not like essential oils that are completely out there. I'm always intrigued. I haven't looked this up, but I probably should. What constitutes a vitamin and what doesn't? And why we no longer discover new vitamins that are necessary? There was kind of a time when we went from A to E, is it? And then we gave up after E. There's no vitamin F.
Is there
or anything like that?
Yeah,
vitamin K.
Yeah.
And then we started numbering things as well. I think here it comes again, Chris, you're a chemist.
Yeah.
And vitamins don't fall into a structural class of molecules.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily small molecules or metal ions or peptides or anything like that. They're not defined by their class of substance, but I think by their essentiality. Is that a word?
Yeah, how essential it is for the body.
Exactly.
And but now we have like essential fatty acids and stuff like that, but they kind of gave up.
Exactly, but we don't call them vitamins. Or also we have essentially amino acids, and we don't call them vitamins either.
Yeah.
So I think they are, I don't even know. Usually they're small molecules. I think all of them. And then we also distinguish between fat soluble and water soluble. But I think, don't we also call some metal ions vitamin? So I think we would as a biochemist, I think would classify them as cofactors.
I think we're getting a bit off topic, so yep. That's crazy. I think it's nice to hear that. Well, not nice to hear. I suppose it's sad to hear, but the fact that he kick-started the vitamin movement is quite quite scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think it kind of points into that we as scientists think, oh yeah, we know the scientific process and we're kind of above the law, so to speak. And we can do wrong because we have kind of science to back us up at all times. But if you leave the field that you are an actual expert in and start doing other kinds of research, like being a great chemist and then going into medical research and just winging it, to be a bit mean here, then you're not bulletproof against doing crappy research and coming to wrong results. I mean...
So at this point, I would like to cite the person that I brought. Okay. He writes, being a Nobel laureate is a license to be an expert in lots of things as long as you do your homework.
Wow. Well, I hope you've done your homework, Hannes. Let's hear who you've brought today.
Should I keep going?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so the person I brought is Kerry Mullis. He invented PCR, the polymerase chain reaction.
Oh, useful.
A method which I think doesn't need any introduction, but I will quickly introduce it anyway. It is, in the end, it's a way to amplify DNA. DNA sequences of almost any length. It's not quite true, and it's a method which revolutionized molecular biology like almost no other method. The things we can do today because of PCR are too many to mention. I have some technical issues here. To just mention a few things. So originally, it was invented in 1938. He got his Nobel Prize in 1993. Originally, it allowed us to work with minute amounts of DNA, which we find somewhere, can then amplify, and then we can do tests like paternity tests. We can use it in forensics. And in more modern application, in the end, it allows us to do sequencing of an entire genome and method like this. So a lot of methods in molecular biology, both in research but also in public applications, are based on PCR. So this, without question, a gigantic thing. Kerry Mullis died last year in 2019, so I feel kind of bad for speaking ill of the dead.
But
having said that,
but Chris forced me to. That. Chris,
yes. <that's> oh, I'm sorry.
Not my choice anymore. I think people called him a eccentric genius. Genius in the sense that he was a great scientist, somewhat unorthodox maybe. And I actually don't know too much about how he came about with PCR and what other things he worked on. Also, would like to mention that I didn't actually fully read his entire autobiography, but from what I've read so far and from the recommendation of my roommate, I should definitely read it. This seems to be a very entertaining book. Maybe not super insightful, though. He seems to be a bit, or seems to have been a bit of a esoteric person, in that he didn't believe many things which were shown by science, had some very, what's that called? I don't know. For example, he did not, he believed in aliens and UFOs. And at some point, I think he believed he saw a fluorescent raccoon.
That's which amazing. You can produce now that we have PCR.
Yeah. GFP raccoon is, that needs to be done.
Yeah, I'm going to pitch it to my boss next week. Which is, of course, yeah, that's not what I want to talk about, actually. Also, he did not believe between the link of AIDS and HIV. So he did not not believe that this human immunosuppressive, is it called that? Immunodeficiency virus caused the disease AIDS. And he was very skeptical about human-made climate change. What I find most interesting, though, is that he was a strong defender of astrology.
Nice.
Astrology being the pseudoscience that the planetary constellation on our time of birth dictate or at least correlate with our personalities and our psychology. These are the bits that I read about in this autobiography. And I found them fascinating because apparently the guy was a genius scientifically, while at the same time he maintained beliefs and made claims which were just like... I can just mention and maybe quote a few things here and there. For example, he said he seemed to have an issue with astrology not being recognized by the social and human sciences. He didn't seem to clash so much with natural sciences and and astrology, which I found interesting. So his criticism was that the human and social sciences, especially sociology and psychology, would not accept that there is an impact of the planetary constellation during your time of birth. And therefore the connection we have with the universe in a very personal and also very holistic sense, I guess. He came about believing this or doubting this when three people in total guessed his zodiac sign correctly.
Just three.
Three, which wow. is, let's not talk about the statistics here.
Well, yeah, do we know how many people also guessed wrong?
We don't know that, but he did the math for how likely is it that three people actually guess correctly.
Right.
Which is like one in 1,700 or something.
Which is a lot. I mean, it's not that much. I mean, that's very likely. That's what I want to say.
Isn't it 12 to the 12 to the 12?
No, 12 yep. times 12 times 12.
Yeah. That's why I'm not a mathematician.
Sure. Let me quickly check if that's actually correct. Yeah, it's correct. So three people guessed Malus's zodiac sign correctly. And this kind of led to the path of his to question that there might be something to astrology rather than what he believed before, it just being bonkers. One of these persons, interestingly, he mentioned they guessed it based on the way how he moved his hand. And this is... Maybe... I'm not sure if this is relevant here, but he also took a lot of LSD throughout his life.
Oh, nice.
So he was... I think this was also part of his journey to develop PCR. Might be too far out there, but I think this is all kind of linked. Right, here's a quote. There is no proven body of facts in the social sciences that say human behavior does not contain elements that are related to planetary positions at the time of birth.
That's terribly unfair. Trying to prove a negative is very hard.
Saying the negative is not proven, that's such a fallacy. Like, such a logical fallacy committed by a Nobel Prize laureate. I don't know.
It's crazy, right?
A bit concerning.
Yeah.
He kind of argues that there's no experiments being done that would challenge that. Or prove it, which in his perception is a flaw in the sciences that the scientists didn't even try to. And he kind of came about this saying that the study of planets initially was done by the same people. So astronomy and astrology kind of went hand in hand. And when astronomy became more of a hard science, people spending more time on telescopes and working with numbers, these were people, I think he implied they're just nerds who don't care about people and cannot relate to people, so therefore they don't care about the psychological impact of their science. And this way, that's why he thought they would omit that. Also, he claimed folklore is a very rich source of new information, given that so many ancient cultures had some kind of astrology in their folklore.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Makes sense, right?
that a lot of these theories kind of draw very loosely from just, culture or ancient people or something and saying, oh, even they knew that already, so it must be true.
Yeah, I find it fascinating how this is used as an argument to discredit modern science by saying, well, if people believe this for thousands of years, it couldn't have been so wrong. Something like, we find evidence for a flat earth in all cultures around the world for like millennia now. Not good evidence. I think it's a very poor argument, but you see it a lot.
Equally, you see a lot of evidence for spherical earth in ancient Egypt and Greek and so on and so forth. So
it wasn't very homogeneous at all. It was not like that these people all believed the earth was round. Quite the opposite. Some people showed... they didn't all believe the earth is flat. Quite the opposite. Some people showed it is round and they could also calculate its diameter. Which is fascinating, I think. Here, another quote. I'm paraphrasing, actually. Not a quote. He was questioning how someone could get a PhD in psychology without even requiring a few courses in astrology. For him, this was so strongly connected, the science of the human mind and all possible explanations, one of them being astrology, the constellation of the planets at our time of birth. This was for him a really big thing.
That's such a fundamental change, though, from him, like the rest of us, thinking that it's bonkers to... saying, oh, every scientist must have courses in it, right? That's such a huge swing.
Yeah.
But do you think it was a swing, or that he, you know, potentially was brought up believing these things, or, you know, in an area where he was told these things, and then he had to go and get a job doing research into DNA, but deep down he was always a astrologer?
I don't think he grew up with it. Apparently it came somewhat later, but I would have to get into his book again, but apparently he held these beliefs before his Nobel Prize, but he didn't grow up with it. I think he was just somewhat esoteric the entire time. And with one of these things, he was on the right track with PCR, but with most other things, he wasn't, apparently. So with Kerry Mullis, I found it interesting that apparently he was like this a bit esoteric and a bit just out of the mainstream through most things in his life, which again shouldn't limit him being eligible for a Nobel Prize, right? The discovery he made was groundbreaking and it changed life sciences as we know it today. Absolutely. And
it's demonstrably correct. Like, we use it every day. It continues to work. It's, you know, I mean, maybe if Mars was to explode, it would stop working, but we're pretty good at the moment.
I find astrology so interesting because it is such an weird connection to make. You have to go through such leaps of faith to accept the implications of astrology. I don't get it.
Yeah, I agree. In comparison to Pauling, at least you could make the argument that vitamin C might be doing something in the body, right?
Well, and it's demonstrably necessary. Like, scurvy was a huge problem, right? And it stopped by having vitamin C. So he's kind of close, but astrology is so far away that...
Yeah, you can do science with that. And again, so Kerry Mullis didn't do science with astrology. He was merely criticizing that there is something to it. It is obvious to him. And he was criticizing scientists for excluding that from their canon of theories, especially psychologists and social scientists, since it's so obvious. And how can you just ignore that? But then we ignore many other things.
So this is kind of cool, because the person I want to bring to this is a nice crossover between the two, Pauling and Kerry Mullis, in terms of pulling on the... taking the paranormal or the kind of astrological, but also now affecting and trying to create research with that. So my homework was on Brian Josephson, and he's a mathematician at Cambridge. He's still alive. He's best known for his work on superconductivity and quantum tunneling, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1973. He's currently a fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, and he was a professor of physics there until 2007. So far, so normal. However, so his dive into the deep end, as it were, comes from his interest in what is charitably called the philosophy of the mind, which was sparked in the late 60s. And okay, another parallel. I'm not sure how much drugs he was on when he got into it, but following the late 60s, he really got into transcendental meditation. And argued that parapsychological phenomena, so like things like telepathy, psychokinesis, and these sorts of things, might be real. He strongly argued for these things to be researched. Once he got his Nobel Prize, there's a tendency for universities to want to keep Nobel Prize winners on their books, because in some sort of unofficial ranking, in the top end of universities, they all count how many Nobel Prize winning scientists are at those institutions. So pretty much once he got the Nobel Prize, he was unfireable. And so he could now indulge in this curiosity to these parapsychological phenomena. So once he got it, he began creating conferences and inviting yogis, so those the sort of masters from India, and I can't remember the name of the guy, but he invited them to come and lecture biologists about the phenomena. And also would go to conferences and recommend that the scientists start reading books by these yogis, particularly the Bhagavad Gita. Really pissed them off. So just as a side note about the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavad Gita is one of the favorite books of Robert Oppenheimer, another Nobel Prize winner. And it's the source of the famous quote, "Now I become death, the destroyer of worlds," which he said when just after he detonated the first atomic bomb. So it's kind of interesting, some parallels here. But yeah, so after this, he starts recommending doing this sort of thing. And he got involved in something called the Fundamental Physics Group, which is physics spelt with an F and a Y, because, you know, it's cool. And was I think it was in Berkeley or something like that. But it was a group of people, scientists, who were looking into these parapsychological phenomena. There's a whole host of examples of both the CIA and scientists in the US really investigating telekinesis and telepathy and these sorts of things during like post-60s kind of thing. There's some really good books on that. But anyway, so coming up closer to the present day, in 1996, he set up the Mind-Matter Unification Project at the Cavendish Laboratory. To explore intelligent processes in nature. And I have just one quote from you, which was from him. He told Physics World in 2002, "Future science will consider quantum mechanics as the phenomenology of particular kinds of organized complex systems. Quantum entanglement would be one manifestation of such organization, and paranormal phenomena the other." So he went, again, really deep into
I wonder how, as a scientist or a person who takes it seriously, you can keep calling it paranormal. Isn't it? Don't you want this to be normal?
That's true.
You think it's real. Don't you want to call it something else? Like, maybe, by calling it paranormal, you keep excluding it from reality.
It's true. We should rename them so we can get some real research getting done.
But I think your quote is really, like, a really interesting example of the pseudoscience way of arguing. Like, he used a lot of words that were like the correct terms, and it like sounded so good up until that moment. So he's like so close, and I think that's one of the reasons why scientists who go like off the deep end in general are really dangerous, because they know how to say it that it just sounds so good, and you need to know your shit to kind of, you know, to not fall into the credibility craze.
Yeah. So given these three stories, and there are more out there, there are some particularly nasty examples of racism and eugenics in other Nobel Prize winners. And eugenics is a big one that keeps coming up again and again. And Hannes has already talked about the HIV/AIDS link denial. So some of these fringe beliefs aren't just funny. They're actually damaging in damaging to society.
But absolutely, yeah.
I suppose the question I have about the Nobel Prize is, do you think there's two reasons for this. Either do you think that the security that comes with winning a Nobel Prize, and the fact that you're pretty much unfireable from any institution you're at or any institution that tries to poach you, gives people or scientists the security to talk about their weird fringe ideas, and they then start to believe their own hype? Or do you think that the minds of scientists who do kind of come up with a groundbreaking discovery are the kind of minds that are sort of tuned to believing a lot of different things, and including these fringe beliefs? And so there's some sort of selection bias when you talk about Nobel Prize winners.
It's really hard to say. And I think it depends so much on the example. Like with Linus Pauling, I was really trying to figure out like what happened. Like there's clear scientific misconduct in his later work. And is that because of his age, or is it because he always had that and he just got lucky that that was not a problem for him? But he got like he got one scientific Nobel Prize. I don't know. It's like really hard to tell. But with Hannes' example, I feel like, well, he was like already in the deep end. And then he also like struck gold in one of his fringe ideas. And that kind of makes sense. But with Linus Pauling, I'm like, yeah, wondering the same thing. Is it like you get the Nobel Prize, or even you get even two, and then you kind of, your ego is so out there that you have no reality check anymore. Or maybe the people interacting with you don't tell you when you're crazy, right? When I say bullshit, like everybody in my lab like tells me, yeah, that's bullshit. But if you're a 2-time Nobel Prize winner, maybe no one gives you any kind of feedback anymore.
I suppose 2-time Nobel Prize winner is even higher up, so that other Nobel Prize winners can't come up to you and be like, this is rubbish, this is bullshit, because you're like, well, I have 2 Nobel Prizes, so I can continue to believe what I'm up to.
Where's your second Nobel Prize?
yeah. If only Marie Curie was out there to tell him to shut up, that would have been great. Yeah.
There are 4 people in total who won 2 Nobel Prizes.
That's true, yeah. Oh. But only Marie Curie in 2 different disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not true. Pauling was the only one in 2 different fields. No.
No, Curie also, physics and chemistry.
Physics and chemistry, yeah.
And there's Sanger for protein and DNA sequencing. And the person who won 2 physics Nobel Prizes, whose name I forgot. It's also not relevant at all.
Anyway, just Hannes, do you want to speak about any of those points? Or what's your take on it?
I think as a scientist, at least the way I and most of the people I talk to these days have a very clear understanding of what is science and what isn't. We have more or less strict definitions of pseudoscience and non-science. Mm-hmm. And bad science, which the experiments that Philip talked about, poorly designed studies or studies that were designed on purpose in a way that they would increase the likelihood of showing the result you want. We call this bad science. We are trained now to distinguish between those. And I would assume a Nobel laureate, as we see them, the best scientists out there, would also. But apparently the evidence shows they're not distinguishing. Maybe not as strictly as we want them to. Maybe not at all. And this raises the question that Chris asked, is that a feature of super successful scientists, like the top 1 ppm almost? Or
are there a million Nobel Prize winners?
No, sorry. The Nobel Prize winners of all scientists.
Okay.
There's only one per... How many active scientists are there right now in the world? We guessed that before, right?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Quite a lot. And then we have to look at the last 120 years almost. So there are very few Nobel laureates, and they're all... We also said this before, sanctified almost for very exceptional work. But if they did exceptional science, is not the same thing. That's not. Like, not all scientific, not all Nobel Prizes are scientific, like literature and peace aren't. And the even the scientific Nobel Prizes don't have to be granted for a science, but can be granted for a development which led to a revolution in science.
I mean, nevertheless, the people we were talking about did great science, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, what do you think?
I think as I'm going to sit on the fence here and say that it's a bit of both. I think you definitely need to be open to thinking differently. I think people who are conservative in their thinking patterns are less likely to come up with a new idea. Especially, it takes quite a lot of arrogance to decide that the current state of affairs is wrong and to think you're going to be able to make a whole new idea. Although it's interesting that some of the fringe beliefs tend to be these sort of ancient mysticism beliefs rather than, say, coming up with their own wholly new, well, apart from polling, wholly new idea that's crazy. But I also think that if, like Philip said, if no one tells you that you're going off the deep end, you begin to believe your own hype, and it gets worse and worse. I think we all know examples of in other fields. It's often in like music and in like actors and this sort of thing, where once they become of a certain status, they completely go off the rails. They then start doing things that no one else really enjoys. So you can always say, oh, their early work was good, but then they went a bit crazy and, you know, the whole thing went off the deep end, as it were. The thing that I'm interested that came up twice was the influence of LSD on this. I wonder how many people begin to lose their minds from certain psychoactive drugs in this sort of thing. So I don't want to get too deep into this, but to sort of finish the episode, I want your quick 30-second reaction. Do you think it's possible that we can separate the person and their fringe beliefs from the science that they did? Or should we always keep that in mind when we're assessing their scientific theories and the things that have come from them?
So the way I would answer that is, I don't like it in science in general when you connect an idea or the origin of a field or a theory with a single person, because there's nothing inherently bad with it, but it doesn't get you where you need to go. So while I was reading like Pauling's CV, I was like getting so excited about him and he's so amazing. And then you read the later stuff and you're like, oh shit, he's just a human. So you can get reeled into this like false sense of there are these geniuses out there that kind of just have it. And it's not like that. Science doesn't work like that. There's never one person. Even if you have a Nobel Prize for three people, it's not those three people, right? It's multiple people.
Yeah, it takes
probably dozens, yeah, if not more. And all of these dozens, hundred people kind of stand on the shoulders of other people who did the work before them, teachers, all of that kind of stuff. So I think in general, it's not a good... I would be happy if we could kind of separate it in the sense of the Nobel Prize for some kind of idea or hypothesis. I think connecting it to the person really doesn't... Yeah, I don't like that idea that much in science in general.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It should be the Nobel Prize for the discovery, not for the discoverer,
yeah,
in
exactly
that sense.
I'm going to be boring and go along the lines of what Philip said, mostly. But I'm going to phrase it a bit different. I like that science is not so much about individual people as much as especially philosophy is, and to some extent maybe sociology. And I personally like that. At the same time, that's a very postmodernist critique. You cannot pretend science grows outside of external factors. That is only about fact and reason and logic, and there's nothing, no external factors, personal factors even shaping science. This is a thing. But I think we should strive for that. We should try to disconnect the science and the facts as much as possible from what is driving us to do it. And when we look back and look at individual arguments, we should try to see for what they are, for experiments, try to look at the outcome in the context of their models and the assumptions, not in the context of the person conducting it and their background. This is something that I would like to see more in a way that's happening, and I like that it is the way. But in the end, it's a whole different discussion than what we had right now. A really deep one.
Yeah, I think this is a great place to end it. I mean, as always, further research is needed, but possibly not into paranormal astrology and whether vitamins can be used to cure cancer. Thank you all for listening. I'm pretty sure the only thing stopping me from getting a Nobel Prize is the worry that I'll go a bit mad. If you want to send us comments, questions, or feedback, you can get in touch on Twitter at FRN-podcast or email under contact@FRN-podcast.com. Next episode, we ask the question, are scientists being censored? If you want to support the show, consider becoming a Patreon. We have exciting rewards waiting for you. Music credits go to Jay Patterson. Thank you all for listening, and please consider subscribing. See you all in 2 weeks.